Today we're here in Hoopston, Illinois with Hal Burge. It is November the 8th, 2007. Videographer is Henry Radcliffe, and the interviewer is Nancy Rotzel. Hal, where were you when World War II started?
World War II, when it started, I was working on the railroad over in Indiana, near Bluffton, Indiana. I was driving along, I was going to meet a girlfriend that afternoon, and then an old couple had a flat tire on the car, and the wind was blowing strong from the west, and I stopped with my car behind them to see if I could help them. I was by myself, and I had an old, back then, a 36 Chevrolet, which wasn't too good, wasn't too bad, and I saw there was two women in the car, and the old man was trying to figure out how to jack it up. So I asked him that they'd just get the women in my car. I left the engine running, the heater was on because it was cold and wind blowing. So I changed the tire, and while they were in my car that Sunday afternoon, the radio on, they heard about Pearl Harbor. And they was both so sympathetic with me because they knew military, you'd get drafted or be in a war. So later on, I wasn't bothered very much with it, but I was thought about it, and I worked at different jobs. I was in Cincinnati, Ohio, working for a while with my uncle that lived over there. I worked in a U.S. printing company along with them, and then I got my draft notice, and this was in the spring of 42. Got my draft notice, and I said, well, I'm going back home and work around Hoopston until they call me to actually go in. So I did come back, and I worked at the canning company share. And I quit the canning company, and I went over to the railroad in Rankin on the section. I worked there until I got my first physical in July of 42 in Danville. And then I later on was called up to report October 20, 1942 was my first induction into the Army. Everything was Army back then. So we went to Chicago and had our physicals and took all this stuff, and the doctors checked us all out real good, make sure everybody was available for service. And very few got turned down. But anyway, they said, go back home and get all your papers in order and everything and report back on November the 3rd. So we did, and I ended up in Camp Grant, Illinois. That's up by Rockford. And spent a few days there, and they assembled a bunch of people to go to basic training. Well, during the time at Camp Grant, we had a battery of tests to take to see what you might be able to do for the government or the Army or the military, whatever. And some men even, I think, got drafted into the Navy or were assigned there. But when I went, they wanted people for tank corps, the medics, or the Air Force. Well, I was just had an eighth grade education, and prior to World War II, you had to be a high school graduate to get in the Air Force. So my thinking that I would never make the Air Force, and I didn't want the medic, so I put in Tank Corps for my first choice, and Army Air Corps would be the second. But I always thought of airplanes. My first ride was in an old tri-motor airplane back in about 1933, and that was a great thing to be up there in the air. So anyway, we get to Keesler Field after about 4 days running around all over the southeastern United States. They didn't want anybody to know where that train was going with all these men on it. And I stayed down there for my basic training. And they was always putting out bulletins or wanting people to join this or that. You know, I wanted to be on an airplane, so I tried to join as a gunner or something like that. But it wouldn't let me because when I passed these tests in Rockford, I'd been made about 98 on my automotive exam because I'd worked on cars before, see, and this and that. In the CC camps, I worked on trucks for 6 months. So anyway, I couldn't go anywhere. So I ended up after my basic training of about 5 weeks. Then we went to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri. That was for overseas training, they called it, and it was not much different than the basic training, but a little bit harder, and we learned to shoot a rifle and this and that down at Jefferson Barracks. Of course, guns were nothing new to me because I grew up with them. My father used to be a gunsmith and had all kinds of guns. We went used to go squirrel hunting, rabbit hunting, pheasant hunting all around Hoopston. Years ago, you could go and find this stuff, and you know, you'd get extra food that way by eating the rabbits or the pheasants. And we did that for years. So anyway, I went at Jefferson Barracks. We left there in February, I believe, early February of 43. From St. Louis and jugged their way out across on a train, a troop train, and I ended up in Fort Lawton, Washington. That's right close to Seattle. So I stayed around there a while, and I got a very high fever one day, one Saturday night. I went to bed, and the next morning I woke up with this high fever, and the orderly room people said, "You don't need to go to the doctors, you're just trying to goof off." You know, that was everybody's thing right then, not do what you're told to do or want to do. But that wasn't the way it was me. So I went to the doctors on my own, and they put me in the hospital for 10 days with a very high fever. And back then, I think penicillin was not new. There was some other medicine they give you. And I finally got through there, come back, and on the 18th of March, Thursday night before, I loaded on a troop ship, and we left out of Seattle on the 18th of March, 1943. We headed to in that passage all the way to Seward, Alaska, and from there we took a train into Anchorage, Alaska. And from there we stayed about a week maybe, a little over, and we got on another train and headed south to a port of Whittaker. It was on the Alaska Peninsula coming down, and we boarded a ship there. And it was about 5,000 men on that ship altogether.
And were all the men the Air Force, the Army Air Force?
No, some of them were different branches.
Okay.
Because a lot of them I never saw. Some of them were Army, and they not Air Force. They were ordnance people on the same one, because that's what I thought I should have been, to be able to work on vehicles, because they wouldn't let me work on them because I wasn't ordnance. So anyway, we go down the islands, and on the way down, we stopped at Kodiak Island just for overnight something. They didn't travel for some reason. And then the next day, we take off and go down to Adak Island. This is a long island chain to go down to the far end of that, too. So I offloaded there, and we spent some time there on Adak. They bivouacked us up in the mountain about 3 miles from the lower base. But I was, we had a CO by the name of Taylor, Major Taylor, and he was a wonderful guy. He reminded me a lot of Clark Gable back then. So he took a liking to me, and I would drive the supply truck, go down, get stuff to bring up for, you know, food and stuff like that. Because we had all these 240 men there, had to eat and sleep somewhere. So we got along good. And then at night, I'd go back and drive a 6x truck and haul bombs from the bomb dump area to the flight line. Now, these bombs, would have been alive, but they didn't have the detonator in the front end of them. And with that, they were no danger of exploding. So I hauled bombs there for quite a while. And then I worked on the docks at night, unloading barges and stuff like that. And every night it would be dark, and we'd have very little lights. And all you could think about was Tokyo Rose is going to have a torpedo from one of their two men subs blow up the docks, which never did happen, because she was always putting out the propaganda on the radio. And you kept track of what we were doing up in the ocean. So finally I got on another boat, and then on down to Attu. While the Battle of Attu was going on, I got down there shortly after it started and set at the dock. The Japanese had an island pretty well built up. You know, they had a dock for unloading stuff. Mm-hmm. So this big ship set up at the dock. And by the next morning I was there, I looked overboard, and there was on the other side, there was one of our submarines docked tied up beside us. So we did nothing but sleep and eat and play cards, and while we were sitting there. We couldn't get off the boat or ship. I said, "You don't want to call them boats, the Navy people. They're all ship." Anyway, we could hear the guns and the battle going on up there further in the mountains. You know. So one day, 6 o'clock in the morning, I was called off to board a barge, and a Navy tug pulled 3 barges about 42 miles southeast of Attu with the island of Shimia. It's a very small island, only about 2 miles by 4. And it sits on a northwesterly angle. And there was nothing on there. No trees was on the island. The only thing was there was some blue fox. And you never seen a, you've seen red fox, but you never seen a blue fox. And they were blue. And anyway, we had to move in on the southeast side of the island. And at the same time, the engineers had built a steel mat runway about a quarter of a mile long. And that's all that was there. No airplanes could land there at that time. So I lived on that south side, and we was living in tents. We had to move our tents around all the time because there was the caterpillars and stuff would take sand away to build a runway base. So finally, my outfit went back. This was in the summer of 43, and the outfit I first went in. Most of them went back to the States, exception 50 of us. And this was in late October of 43. And I was one of the 50 who had to stay on the island. And I cried like a mongoose because I never went to any schools. I didn't cost the government anything. And here, you won't let me do the job I want to do, but you're going to keep me here. So, in the meantime, I'd been working in supply in various places. Salvage yard, when the airplane crashed, I'd take the good parts off and we'd put back in supply so they could be used on other airplanes. They did that for a while, and then the outfit broke up, like I said, and I had to stay. So the maintenance officer had to stay, a lieutenant by the name of Ernest Taylor. He had been a lawyer out of Tennessee, and he was a nice guy, just a southern boy. So after that, I was working in salvage, tearing up the airplane, and I told him, I said, since you're short of mechanics up there, why can't I work on an airplane? I said, I know mechanics, you can check my records and see that I passed automotive real good. So he did. Then I started working on airplanes. My first airplane was a P-40, and it's a fighter plane. We had those on the island. And they were the ones that liked to do China, India, Burma Theater over there. They had lots of P-40s. Anyway, that was my first airplane. They had books. All the airplanes had books. We had a different section of the airplane was covered in a book. If you could read or write and you could understand, you could fix an airplane. There's some technical stuff that some people could never do. Anyway, I started working on the airplanes, and the P-40s had a bad habit of the landing gear getting dirt in the gear mechanism, and they wouldn't retract when you come into land. So they'd make a belly landing, make a good belly landing, and it would tear up the wing and the propeller and the engine, but the fuselage was still there. So we get from the States, they'd get new wings in a big box. The wings would have the landing gear and the fuel tanks and everything in there except in the fuselage. You took this all apart, bolted it on. There's a jillion bolts on both sides of the fuselage. You bolted to this wing. Everything was precision made, and we put a new engine on the fuselage, the mounts and everything, a new propeller, and it'd be ready to fly again. One day we didn't own the airplane. This squadron did not own the airplane. It belonged to a fighter squadron. And we give it back to the squadron. And 2 days later, they don't trust anybody, see. They had to tear it apart, and they ended up messing it up. They got the throttle linkage. You could turn a bell crank on the outside of the firewall one way, and it would make throttle wide open. Or if it was the other way, it would be closed when you thought it was closed. So this one day, one of the pilots cranked up the engine and he thought it was closed throttle, but it was wide open. The engine started up and I don't know why it ever did, so any of them took a little time to start up, but that thing nosed over and tore up the prop and the engine again right there, and they had to take care of that themselves. And another one, about 2 weeks later, we'd sent back, and everything was test hop from our squadron for it to go back to their squadron. The airplane was in good condition to go back, and about the second time it flew, the pilot was landing, and it was down toward our maintenance area. He was landing on from northwest to southeast, and he put the brakes on a little bit, and the right brake locked up on it, and it pulled him off the steel mat runway into the sand along the side of the runway. So, I mean, it started pulling off while he put the other brake on to hold it. But anyway, the airplane tipped clear over, from the nose and landed upside down. He was going maybe 50 or 60 miles an hour by that time, and it tilted it clear over on the nose, upside down. And there he is with his shoulder harnesses on, and right behind the pilot, there was a gas tank, fuel tank, but there's a fuel filter cap right back of his head about less than a foot away, and fuel was running out. This 130-octane fuel, high-octane gasoline, very explosive, and there's some engineers were working on the side of the runway filling the sandbag with sand, and I saw the airplane do this because, you know, you just nose around when you're working on your own airplane, whiz out in the open all the time working on airplane. So I saw it tilt over, and I ran down there, and these engineers had beat me there, and they had these little trench shovels, we call them, filling sandbags, and I was beating on the canopy. The canopy slid back and forth right over the pilot's head, and boy, I got down there and stopped that because one little spark that could have caught the airplane on fire, and that man would have died right there. So I couldn't get his belt loose without cutting it because the way they were made and designed and hit all his weight on it. So he fell out on the ground and didn't hurt him anything because it was right there 2 foot from the ground. And it was upside down like that because the tail end was holding it off the ground. Anyway, that afternoon, he had to go take another flight. They don't let them just stand around and think about what happened. They make them go on another airplane right away, or they lose their nerve to fly. And that afternoon, he came down and told our little major. We had a major that had 32 years in the service, Major Tracy. We called him Dick Tracy when he wasn't around. Anyway, he knew he was an old 32-year-old military man and knew it all. But anyway, that afternoon, this captain come down. He says, "Where's that sergeant to save my life?" Well, he called me in. He says, "I want him to run around with me this afternoon if you don't care." And he had a fifth of whiskey. We didn't get drunk, but we did drink some of it. And anyway, I didn't get any recognition for that. It was just in your daily work. You know, that's part of your job. But if I'd have been boy working in the orderly room or somebody, I'd have got a ribbon for that, but I didn't get many ribbons during World War II. So that was just another part of my day's work. They figured it, and it happened later on after the war. I was in Duluth, Minnesota, and I saved an airplane there, but I didn't get any recognition for it because that was my job. Anyway, after that, we moved up into different quarters of Pacific huts along the runway. And the first Sunday, I think it was 44, a B-24 was on takeoff raid to go to Japan, northern Japan. There was 12 of them in the flight. And I don't know, maybe number 3 or 4 on takeoff. He lost control of the airplane. It crashed into 2 other parked airplanes and a building, a small Quonset hut. It was an evacuation building for guys that was going back to state to spend the night there maybe, or medical evac. So that fell on the ground about 150, 200 feet away because it wasn't that high. See, that's why he ran into the airplanes. He was flying along and we had a crosswind. And the crosswind was from the west, southwest. And these two buildings up there, when the pilot was controlling the airplane to fight the crosswind, but when he got to the buildings, they broke the crosswind up and created a vacuum. And he pulled over to the left and ran into these parked airplanes. And anyway, when the airplane landed, it landed upright, but it had the wheels coming up at that time. So about then, a minute after he landed, a 500-pounder bomb detonated. It dropped out of the bomb bay shackle and detonated. See, when they put the bombs in there and they put the detonator in the end of it, they have a wire that's hooked to the bomb bay rack. So when that bomb leaves, the wire pulls out and the bomb is active. It's alive. From that on, and it only fell a little bit, but it fell right on the nose and blowed up, and it killed everybody on that airplane but the pilot and the tail gunner. And I had the privilege of helping clean up the mess the next morning on a Sunday morning. I'd find men's hands and gloves and feet with shoes in them, and they're just really something you don't want to see. I couldn't eat for 2 days, and the bombardier setting up in the nose section. When this hit, it slid into what we call a generator house. It was a place we had a generator for runway lights. And the boy that run that, he was out along the runway about 80 or 90 feet away. And he started, when it happened and he ran into his building, he ran toward the airplane. And about that time, the bomb went off and he got killed from concussion out there. And he wasn't even in the airplane, but that's how close he was. And it was the airplane, the way it landed, there was a little ridge on the left side of it about 50 feet away. And it went down into the ordnance people area and they found the pilot and gunner down in that section. They weren't even on the airplane. They were down in that section when they found them dazed. So we lost, that was 9 men on that airplane lost that morning. So anyway, that was just more work, the type of work I did. And I was on the salvage, rebuilding airplanes. I was on the fire crash crew, because when I first got there, we had a civilian fire chief, but he was on the main side of the island, but it was a mile away from us. So anytime we had a crash or anything, we'd have a pickup truck and a trailer with just fire extinguishers. And one truck we had was served water for the bay, for our area, you know, just got water out of the lake, but it had usually 500 gallons of water on it all the time. And we'd have it to fight fires. So I fought many fires as a different airplane crashes. And when they crash, they're pretty dangerous stuff still until you get them deactivated, the batteries out, the guns disarmed and all that stuff. So there's one time in 44, I was working down in the flight line, in the hangar. We had a hangar by then built, a big wooden hangar that's a Corps of Engineers built, I guess. But we was working in there one day and this B-24 come in, and at the end of the runway they had some heavy 8x8s, I think, with a couple of little antennas on for the final approach for these airplanes, because much of the time in the summer up there in the Shimia, the fog was real heavy. I mean, it would stay for days and you wouldn't see the sun. It was just that heavy fog. But he made a pass and then he come back around and did land, but he hooked the right main landing gear on one of these big beams there and knocked it loose. When he landed on the main left main and the nose gear, the right one was collapsed, so that drug the airplane and made a big U-turn. Well, it made a U-turn and was headed toward the opposite way it come in. And when it did, it ran off the runway, and there was a small ditch where they'd used for the sand to build a runway. They made a ditch there. It had about 2 foot of water in it, about 6 foot wide. And the wingtip hit a dirt bank a little higher above the ditch. At the same time, one of the officers was getting ready to get out of the airplane right back of the pilot. And he was there's a hatch back there about 2 foot wide and maybe 3 foot long. There's a curve to fit the fuselage. So when he was up there to get out, the wingtip hit the dirt bank. The number two engine was still turning. And when it made the sudden stop, he flew into the right number two engine propeller. Well, I'm down there fighting fire, and with the fire chief finally got over there. And all we had was fire extinguishers, but when the airplane crashed, a fuel line came loose and caught fire. Gasoline was running out of the wings right on top of that water, and fire was on the water, and we were sucking water out right under the fire to put the fire out. And the chief got down there. He had 5 gallon cans, I think they call it, said it was horse blood, but it would smother the fumes. So if you don't have the fumes, you don't have a fire. You take something away, oxygen or whatever. Anyway, I'm up on top of the wing of that B-24, and everything's all wet. And I slipped off to the back side and landed in the water about 2 foot deep. And I felt something there, didn't feel normal. They'd been yelling, there's one man missing, see, by then. I knew there was one man missing. So I stepped on his arm or something. So I reached down in the water and started to pull him up. I got under his arm, and he was cut about half in two. And I yelled for the medics to come over there because I wasn't the medic, and they got him out finally. But he was the only one got killed on the airplane. But that was a crash. But that airplane was not rebuildable. It broke in two and all that stuff with the fire. So anyway, in 1940, well, they built a breakwater. The airplane wouldn't have a decent dock and a cove for ships parking, so they built a big breakwater out there. It was about 40 foot high, and they block and a half, 2 blocks long, just to keep the water, because the weather up there was so bad and the old Bering Sea was so rough. If anybody ever watched these programs like the Fishing Fleet up there now and how they battle the waves in the Bering Sea? Anyway, there's a big storm come up and tore that breakwater down. That's how bad the waves were. But in the meantime, I got a mainland recuperation furlough in November of 1944. A lot of people didn't want to take it because it was afraid it would affect their rotation date. Well, our CO had been a professor over at the University of Illinois, and I talked to him about, I said, nobody seems to want to go up there, but I'd like to go. I said, how's this going to affect our rotation date? He said, Sergeant Burge, but when you leave, we'll give you orders so you'll be covered from the base, but when you get back, the orders are tore up and there's nothing on your record, see? Because you got 30 days vacation every year. And if you didn't take it, you could build up and you got paid, you know, so many, if you, like when I retired, I got paid for a couple months of vacation. I wouldn't know where to take it. But that one time. Anyway, I went up to the mainland and spent a month up there. And then when I came back on a boat, on a civilian steamship company, regular, it wasn't the military, but it was hired by the military to transport troops. So I ended up on the AT-2 in a casual company called waiting to get a boat to come back to Shimia. So it's up there in the mountain about 3 miles from down to the base, but you can see the air base down there. And we had some B-24s, the 404th Bomber Squadron or the Photo Recon Squadron had these B-24s painted black for radar resistance. So they were photo jobs. They run over northern Japan, take photographs all the way down as far as they could go and get back home. So I saw that airplane land, and I asked the first sergeant, I said, can you give me that mail boy that drives that Jeep, take me down there so I can get back to Shimia, because I don't want to be up here in the casual company doing nothing. So I went down, talked to the pilot, and he said, sure. So we get up, and we get in the fog. You could see the island once we got a little airborne, but the fog sets in real quick. So we couldn't see it when we first got over there. So all I think about is this airplane going to crash like the one it did before. I want to bail out. So anyway, we got in there, and the fog cleared enough and made a perfect landing.
Where were the planes going out of the airport?
Out of Shimia, they bombed Japan and northern Japan and the Korea Islands. One day we fixed up a B-24 with the larger oil tanks on it and everything. It was a photo recon job, and it flew down and was out 24 hours. Of course, it had Bombay fuel tanks in, didn't have any bombs, taking pictures. And everybody was worried that it was lost. And it really wasn't. It was still airborne in 24 hours, one on that one without landing. So others went down there. We had one who went down there with the Zeros got after it and shot the number three engine oil cooler out. But the pilot didn't want to shut that engine off, just have to, because if he's got a dead engine, they're all going to really gang up on him. So he let it windmill. The engine, the wind and the other three engines pulling aircraft caused the windmill. The engine would keep turning over, but it wouldn't have any power. So finally, since it ran out of oil, it stripped some reduction gears on the prop to the engine, and it windmilled all the way back, but the engine wasn't turning then. And it was so bad that the wind propeller was hitting the cowling on the leading edge, which it should never hit in normal time, but that's how bad. But anyway, the pilot and the co-pilot both got shot pretty bad. And the flight engineer was a tech sergeant. He's a guy that knows more about the airplane than anybody else. He's in charge of the maintenance on it, on the ground and in the air. Anyway, he got down out of after they got out of the combat area, he got down and got in the pilot, relieved the pilot, got him out of the seat, and flew that airplane back to the island of Shimia. I forget how many hours that trip was when they got shot up bad. But he landed it, too. So enlisted men could fly an airplane.
What happened if they didn't make it back?
Well, I'll tell you, most of the time, I would have to set up at night when a mission was still out and wait, we get word, we'd wait and wait, 10 o'clock at night maybe, and we get a call in. We wouldn't have any runway lights on until we knew they was about ready to come in. 10 o'clock at night, you get a call that we're out 15 minutes away, on the way in. Never hear that airplane again. They ran out of gas, landed in the Bering Sea or the North Pacific, and you never find anything of any of them. 11 men would be gone to the airplane because the water is so cold. Even if they had bailed out or was in a raft, most likely would have died within 30, 40 minutes from the cold weather. The water was so cold up there. And we lost many of them that way, B-24s and some B-25s and about every other airplane.
You said some of them ended up in Russia.
Yes, some of them would get shot up and crippled up bad. They had a business deal with Russia that they could fly into Russia and be interned. But Russia would take and keep the airplane. Well, their internment more or less acted like they were prisoners of war from what I could hear back then. They never come back to the island we were on. They were relieved after the war. But that's how Russia treated our people back in, during the war. We were still their enemy. It's just when, even after the, I went back into service after I got out and was in what they call the Cold War. And we had to be on guard against Russia the whole time, and we still should be today. They're a different group. I don't know why. I guess they hate us because we didn't, or Reagan maybe make them tear down the wall. I don't know what it was. But anyway, I stayed up there and done all that stuff, met a lot of good people. I met some people. You meet all kinds of people, but some of them are a lot of friends, but some are real close friends. I had this one guy I used to work with by the name of Jim Kreider in Knox, Indiana. He was a young, we were all young punks, full of energy and didn't know what to do with it all. We had a little hobby shop there. We learned photography. We had a little boxing, but I didn't like boxing because I didn't like to get hurt. Anyway, Jim and I had worked on airplanes. So one day there was a Navy airplane come in, a C-45. This is a small twin-engine airplane. I have five people on board, but it flew in from AT-2, and it was having engine trouble. So I'm in the hangar working on a big Martin B-26 that had crash-landed, or landed and taxi, and he ran off the runway and tore up the wing and the aft section. So I was rebuilding that airplane, and they had this maintenance officer, a new guy, come out of South. He's from North Carolina. His name was Boatwright. But when he first got there, he'd tell us, "Now I'm Captain Boatwright, and you're so-and-so," and that's the way we were going to talk to people. Well, us old-timers didn't quite approve of that. So one day, nobody talked to him. One day he asked me, he said, "What's the matter with these people? They won't talk to me." I said, "Well, you want to call them soldier or boy? You said you were Captain Boatwright, and that was your name, and we were Sergeant so-and-so, but you never used those terms to us, and I think you're getting a cold shoulder." But he mellowed out, changed real quick. But anyway, the C-45 landed that one morning, and I'm inside, and of course we get to hear the noise, and the line chief and the number one guy he thought was great was trying to fix this airplane out there. It wouldn't run right. So I kept teasing this captain. I said, "Hey, if you had a good mechanic out there, they'd been on their way back home to AT-2. So about 3:30 in the afternoon, I said, "Captain, tell you what, you let me and Jim Kreider and I, we'll come back and fix that airplane after we eat supper." He said, "All right, if you think you can do it." So we went back there, and this radial engine, the engine, you'd rev it up to about 1,800 RPM and it'd start backfiring, so it wouldn't go any higher. So Jim and I went out there, and I said, "Jim, it's got a valve problem somewhere." I said, "You start up at the number one cylinder and work your way down." It had little covers on the valve cover on the cylinders, two valves on each cylinder, so I had two little caps like with four little bolts. You'd take them off and you check the valves. You'd have to rotate the engine or propeller to make sure it was on top dead cylinder and all that stuff. And I said, "I'll start on the bottom and work my way up the other side." They had in the very bottom a little thing called a sump pump. The oil on these was not like in a car. It wasn't in the crankcase. It was in a tank back there. They had a pump to pump the oil in and a pump to pump the oil out, back out. So it never had, it wasn't full of oil. So he worked his way down. If we really didn't examine it real close, we'd have saw this one cover right next to his, would be his last one. It was bulging out a little, just kind of cracks, but not enough to leak oil. So we've adjusted that one valve, put everything back together in about an hour and a half, and running the engine, checked out perfect. So I called up this boatwright, the big shot, turned out to be a nice guy after a while, and told him to get the pilot and the crew down here. That airplane's ready to fly. He couldn't believe it, so he come down there, and I had to show him getting the car. He didn't know how to fly. He wasn't a pilot. He was just a maintenance officer. Got him, showed him how. I said, just see both engines running perfect. I said, the airplane's ready to go. So we got a gas truck and gassed it up, and he went and got to hold the Navy crew, and they flew out of there that night to go 42 miles away. But the reason I knew what I was talking about, I asked the crew chief. They had a crew chief that flew on that airplane, a flight engineer like I turned out to be later on. And I said, when was the last time you had a 100-hour inspection on this engine and they may have set the valves? He said, about 5 or 6 hours back. Well, anyway, when they set the valves, they didn't tuck up the lock nut on the adjustment screw on the valves. And that had come loose. And that one rocker arm was just a flopping to beat the band. And when it got a certain RPM, it would pop that one valve open just by bouncing this rocker arm. So that was the clue that I knew what I was working on, already looking for the trouble by what the crew chief told me.
Why were you sent to the Aleutians?
Say again?
What was the main reason for sending you to the Aleutians? What part of the war were you fighting, in essence?
We were in, the Japanese had already landed up there in Dutch Harbor or someplace, and was already on the island of Kiska. And the general up there, against the government's orders, didn't want to, but he built a runway down on the island of Adak, see, and that was where we ended up, first island I landed on. It was a kind of a mountainous island. It was had a low area, and they went in there, and no time at all, the engineers, they pulled sand from everywhere and pumped water out of ponds and made a runway in a very short time. And that's where the jumping off point, and that's when they started to really fight the war of Kiska and At Two. The men were already there. They bombed and bombed and bombed both places before they ever landed any troops there. I had all this bit on the paper that's showing in my stuff I brought today, which show day by day about how things went on in the Aleutian Islands. But Aleutian Islands was a secondary thing, and we was kept up there to keep them from coming forward and also make them tie up troops so it wouldn't be able to go to the South Pacific. That would be less firepower they had down there if they were being invaded by the North.
Did you know a lot about what was happening in the other theaters?
Well, we had what they call orientation movies. We'd get about once a month or so, and we'd go to a theater or in the hangar, and they'd show the movie, and we'd get orientation, know what was going on in Germany and the South Pacific somewhat, yes. We did have that, yeah. And we eventually, they built up. We was living in tents for a long time and in the Pacific huts, and then eventually moved into they built a mess hall, a big mess hall, and it was designed as an H figure, letter H, you know, the center sections where the cook all took place, but the other side was this seating room for everybody. So this little friend of mine from California, Malcolm Ford, he's a little guy, from Sacramento, California, he worked in supply, and everything would come in, the movies would come into supply, and we didn't. They were supposed to go to the theater 2 or 3 days now, but we set up all night and watched 2 or 3 movies in our, we had a projector, and we set up all night in that part of the mess hall. It wasn't used. We see the movies before they ever got to the base.
What kind of movies?
All kinds of just westerns and whatever. Yeah, back then. Once in a while, there'd be a little bit on about the war elsewhere too. But most of that was come through the government orientation movies. We'd have to go see. So that was a big part of it too. And I would say out of the group that went back when I would have liked to have gone, they rotated back through the States, and some of them, but lower ranking airmen, got assigned to the infantry, and they ended up in the South Pacific getting killed. So after I found all that out, I thank the Lord that I stayed right where I was, because I wasn't in any real danger. Now, we did have a couple of airplane raids on At Two while I was there. That was 42 miles away, but we had the fighter planes on our island, and they had mostly some fighter planes over there, but mostly B-25 bombers. But the Japanese come in with a fleet of 12 bombers, and they tell me that the Japanese only had one bombardier and navigator, and everybody else followed suit. See, that's how bad off they were with personnel. When the first guy done his work, they had a certain time to drop theirs after. But anyway, when they had the two raids over there, why, our base commander wouldn't let the P-38 airplanes that we had. They were a long-range airplane, could really fly, outrun anything that the Japanese had at the time. But we had the P-40s could stay on our island, patrolled, because they figured that we were going to be the main hitting place. This is just a lead on over there to defect what was going to happen to us, because we was where the big bombers flew out of. But the P-38s could have flown over there and shot all those down if they'd have let them go, and that didn't happen, though. Two different times, we was in our foxhole. I was hoping for it, because I'd like to shoot a rifle, try to hit an airplane, but it never happened. So that was some things that we had to live with all the time, and they had no more raids after that. Two times is the only times they come back to try to bomb that too. And when they did, there were ships in the harbor, but they never hit one. They hit the water and never did hit a ship. No damage was done, as far as I can remember. And anyway, after the war, the big war was over there, excuse me, first of May, end of May, they'd hear a message, coded message, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And they couldn't figure out where it was coming from. So once they decided, we're going to keep this everything down, no communication going anywhere, around 2 to 3 or 4 in the afternoon, if possible. So they could still hear the message. So later on, there was a Navy guy that come in on a ship, and he wanted to go up, see where the battleground was and all this and that. So he's up there trudging around on the tundra and the side of the mountain and fell in a hole. Well, in this hole, there's a Japanese with a shortwave radio, hand crank job. He could sit there and he could look right down on the runway, maybe a mile and a half, mile down there, and see everything going on. And he was sending out reports every day, the activity at the runways. So he was scared, but he got the Jap, and they got him down. And I saw him. He flew through. They transported him out of there in a day or two, I suppose, after all the interrogation over that, too. But they landed on the island I was on to pick up other troops to go back to the mainland. But that was the only one Japanese left, as I can remember. Everything else, they died during the war because the commanding officer forced them to commit hara-kiri. You know, they try to killed our people. They even killed their own people in their dispensaries. So they didn't. That was their way of doing. Don't get captured. Those Americans are too rough on you. So I think most of them were not captured. Just him. But he would slip down at nights and steal food from the mess hall, and that's how he lived. And this was about 2 months later, 3 months at the most, that he was still there. Well, anyway, I stayed on the island end of May of 1945 because I was one of the oldest guy on the island because I come over on the barge as the first one to hit the island. And so I was one of the first ones to go out of our squadron. I was going to join another outfit in Alaska, Anchorage. It was the 39th Air Depot Group. They did major work on airplanes also. But anyway, I got back up there, and the CO had been our maintenance officer when I first went down to the island of Shimia. He ran around with dark sunglasses on all the time, and we called him the Green Hornet, but not in his face. Anyway, he saw me, and he said, "Sergeant Birds, there's nothing for you to do. You don't need to get a toolbox or nothing. Just stay around till we go back to the States." Yeah, I said, "When that go away?" He said, pretty soon. This was in the 1st of June by then. So there was 4 of us in that group, and we were in town one day, didn't have nothing to do. We could do anything we wanted to stay out of trouble. So we were in town one day, then one afternoon, I can picture it right now, walking along the street, and the second lieutenant was there, and we just walked on by and never saluted him. You know, you had to salute these officers. And he took my name, turned me in. So next day, I got called into the major, the captain. He hadn't made major yet. And he says, "What's going on?" And I said, "I don't know what you mean." He said, "Well, you were in town yesterday, and you didn't salute this second lieutenant." Not used to saluting people too much. Captain Swanhart was his name. Anyway, he said, you know better than that, so we didn't get any punishment for it, but, you know, he just told us, don't be that way again. Give them all the...
Did your family know where you were?
My family did not know from the time I left Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, and went to Seattle and wrote a few letters, but I don't know where I'm going out of Seattle, Washington. From the time we rode on that ship, everything was top secret. You didn't write anybody, you didn't call anybody and tell them anything. One time while I was out in Shimia, the way the island is, and the international date line comes down and it jogs out to cover all the island chain. That too, and then it goes straight south. I forget where it goes down, maybe close to Midway. The international date line. So I tried it. Write it in a letter, and I don't know if my folks would have understood it anyway, you know, unless you know geography fairly well. I said, I should be into tomorrow, but this today is a date, and I got censored for that because all of our mail was censored by an officer. And he called me in, and I had to rewrite the letter, and he warned me not to do anything like that again. That's the closest they ever come to trying to let them know, but they did not know because everything was an APO number. And out in Seattle, Washington, they had APOs, and maybe some went to the South Pacific, but everything in Alaska and up there was I think ours was 729. And that's people in the post office don't know anything about where it is, really, so they can't tell anybody either. 729 was the APO number, and that would be the island of Shimia, where I was on. The other different ones had different APO numbers, but nobody knew anything until I come back from the from Alaska. We got on a ship, or we got on a train in Anchorage and come down to Stewart and got on another train and come clear across Canada on train to Edmonton, Canada. We had a layover there about 4 hours one afternoon, and I sent a telegram to my mother down in Hoopston, Illinois, and said that I'd be home in a few days. And that was the first I could say, and that's all I said. Didn't say where I'd been or anything else, just I'd be home in a few days. I had two other brothers in the service at the same time. One of them was both were in the Navy, and the younger one was on a submarine during the war, and the other was on a destroyer escort in the South Pacific. So that was the first time my mother or anybody knew I was in town. So we come into Camp Grant, stayed a couple of days there, and got turned in some stuff and got some different clothes. And then a friend of mine by the name of David Brown from Rossville, he'd went in at the same time I did. There's a whole other group, but he was the only one that went end up where I did. He come down to the island shortly after I did and stayed a little while and went back to the mainland, but that was the same squadron I joined, the 39th Air Depot, when I come back to the States. So him and I leaked up together, you know, and we come into Camp Grant and we had to get processed and we came to Chicago first and then back to Camp Grant and got processed, and we were supposed to leave in Chicago and go to Roswell, New Mexico. This is all just before the war is over. We were supposed to start, the whole unit was going to start a new outfit in Roswell, New Mexico. So while I'm home, We were supposed to report back to Chicago, which we did in 30 days. But in the meantime, the war got over. I was home in Hoopston up here when the first atomic bomb was dropped. I was right here in Hoopston in August of 1945.
Do you remember the reaction?
Yeah, I was thrilled to death myself. And then most other people around here were. But, you know, at the time, there's many people still open their mouth and protest that we dropped that bomb. And they don't realize if they'd never been in war, and most of them had never been in war, sat around blowing their mouth, that how hard it would have been to invade Japan, because every man, woman, and child would have some kind of weapon to kill those Americans. So we didn't have to invade Japan. Now, my younger brother on submarine duty, he was in Tokyo Bay two or three different times with subs, taking pictures at night. They had a submarine net, they called it, but somehow they knew how to get when it would be up and when it would be down. When one of their ships would move in or out, they'd move in too. But they'd take pictures at night. They never torpedoed anybody in the bay. That wasn't their job, but they knew what it was, looked like over there. And it would just been terrible if we, you know, we'd been bombing them, but they didn't want to surrender. So when Truman gave the order, dropped the big bomb, that was the greatest thing, one of the biggest deals he did. And that didn't cool them off quite enough yet, so he dropped a second one. So that took the wind out of their sails. They had to give up.
Yeah. When you look back at that time, what would you say about your experience? All worthwhile,
upsetting? I tell you, I'm going to say this, and it's on film right now. I think World War II is the greatest thing that ever happened to our country. We was in a depression. Everybody was on, well, I grew up on welfare. I don't care. And just like people today, the food man come around and delivered food stuff. My mother worked at what they call a WPA thing for women. There was a sewing center here in Houston, right up on Market Street upstairs there. The old buildings are tore down now. But women worked up there, made clothes for the poor people. And she made $48 a month working there 40 hours. Now, that was a big deal, but that was better than doing nothing. But anyway, I had grew up and I'd jerked sweet corn. Everything was used to be jerked by hand around here. Canning factories run all day long, and I started out about 14 years old, out in the fields at 2:30 in the morning. Team of horses, if it was raining, you still was there, jerking those ears of corn off by hand. I did that for a couple of years. It was hard work. The first week or two, your fingers would bleed because the husk would tear your skin off. Anyway, I done that a while. Finally, I got a job inside the plant, you know, and then later on, like I say, I was out of work. I quit the railroad job because it was just too hard to work. And on the railroad one day, well, this was before the war, of course, I was doing a job, and the big boss told me what to do. But the straw boss told me I was going to do something else, and I told him I wasn't going to do it. They had these big jacks they jack up the track with, and he was going to tell them. I had to carry these big jacks two at a time. Here I'm about 125-pounder, and I let him know I wasn't going to carry those jacks. And I walked back through the work gang, and the big boss was sitting on a rail back there. And I got past him about 10 feet. He says, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm quitting." And what happened? And I told him. He said, "You go back up there and do what I told you, because I'm the boss, and don't you pay attention to the other guy." The other guy's name was White Neck. The other one, the main boss, was from over here in Ambie. I can't call his name right now, but he passed away several years ago. Real nice guy. Anyway, I gave up the railroad and went to Cincinnati, Ohio, worked for the U.S. Printing Company a while. That's when I got the draft notice over there. Then afterwards, I got out of the service, and well, there was many different times as airplanes crashed up there that I rebuilt a Martin B-26 that crashed, P-38s. Two were flying one day, and the second man was so close, he flew up, and the P-38 had a double boom on the tail section. And the one on the right engine flew up the left boom of the other and then chewed it off and almost all of his elevator controls. And the one that lost his propeller, the one that hit the first airplane, and he flew back to at two on one engine, but he had good control. And since our island was pretty well flat, the one that got the main damage, he landed on our island. And I had the privilege of, with four other boys, you know, I was in charge of rebuilding that airplane, take off of another airplane that made a pretty good crash landing. We took off the parts off of one and put them on the other one and had to re-rig it and everything and in about a month and a half, and it was ready to fly again. But the P-40s was the same way. They barely landed. We, like I say, we got the big wing and the box and put them back together in about 10 days. And they would fly. But later on, the war was winding down. They knew it. They was going to send these P-40s back to the mainland. But on the way back to ADAC or somewhere, they lost two out of the four. So they decided when one of them crashed or belly landed again, that we wouldn't fix it. So on one end of the island, there was a high bluff to the water, and I was in charge of the crash crew also. So I had made a cable section so I could pick up this one P-40 with a wrecker, a nice big wrecker we had with a boom on it. So I just made these cables well balanced. So when it crashed, we'd pick it up, just right on the back of this big truck, carry it over to the bluff, about a half a mile away, and unhook my cables and everything. We set it in such a fashion, all we had to do was lift up the one wing and tip it over into the Pacific, or Bering Sea, that's where it would be. We did several that way.
Have you ever gone back?
No, I've never gone back. I would like to, but I've never caught the occasion when some group would be going. Now, the island itself is closed down to, well, they named it after the war later on, the Ericsson Air Station or something like that. And there's a few people out there yet, I guess, maintaining some of the buildings and all. And it's an emergency landing for commercial airlines. It flights that fly, say, from here to Chicago to Tokyo. There's a route they fly with not too far from Shimea. But they made it a law now, since they got so many big twin-engine airplanes that can fly all the way nonstop. In case they have an engine trouble, they'd have a place to land. I read the story one time, they'd have to have, I think, 1,500 miles of landing base, and this would be the only place they could. But if they made a crash landing on the island, they really don't have too much for the medical attention there, from what I read also.
Do you know what else is there? Is there anything else on the island?
Well, there's a few civilian things going on all the time there, but I don't know what all they are. Weather people and this and that keep track of things. But as far as the Air Force, the air base, it's closed down for air base people. But I watched it grow from, like I say, about a fourth of a mile of runway to even blacktop. And during the war there, they had a company out of Wyoming or somewhere, Knutson Construction Company, I think the name was. They come in there and set up a asphalt plant, and they eventually blacktopped the runway. And while they were doing it, Tokyo Arose people knew about it because submarines out there were taking pictures that all this smoke going on. The blacktop machine made a lot of white smoke, see. So we had to hear that all the time. We had a radio. We couldn't get the States, but we would get Tokyo Arose quite often on the radio. So that period of time, we weren't really worried too much about getting bombed by them by then because the war was over with that too. And they were concentrating more on the south. You know, they had lost the Midway Island down there, and they come up to attack us, but didn't do any good. Of course, that was all wartime, and I enjoyed being there. You get lonesome, you know, when everybody but 50 of us stayed, I was kind of upset. I'd like to have gone home like everybody else would. You don't want to be out to this 2-4 mile island. It is a small island. The wind blew. Anytime you was on the beach, the wind was blowing in your face. We all had a little tan because of the wind and the sand. There wasn't that much sun, and it was not extremely cold in the winter. I mean, about 15 above was about the baddest I think it was. And I'll tell you another thing. When I went back to the mainland, before I left, all these guys, bring us some fresh milk, bring us some fresh milk. Oh boy, how am I going to do this? So I get up there, and I'm getting ready to come back. There was no fresh milk up there. It was all recombined or frozen milk, see. So I said, well, the Red Cross would give us a little ditty bag, you know, with stuff in it. So I had this little bag, and I went to the commissary. And the day before I left, and I got 6 quarts of frozen milk. Carnation was the label. This fit in this little bag. I lugged that around, got on a ship, I rode the train down and to Whittier, and it was cold, so it didn't worry about spoiling. So I got on the ship, and I looked all around, where am I going to put this milk? So I put it in a lifeboat. It was real cold. Put it in the lifeboat, and every day I'd check that lifeboat. It had a cover on it, see, make sure that milk was there. So I got down there and got off the boat. I tucked the milk, went up into the transit area where I had to stay a few days before I caught that ride of the B-24, and I put it in a snowbank up there. And when I come back to Shimea, I had it, and when I got to the barracks, our barracks are Pacific huts, and they were put in the ground about 4 foot deep, and there was snow all around. So when I first get to the barracks, I stick it out in the snowbank. And that night, I... 1 minute? Anyway, that night, they asked me, did you bring that milk back? Oh, I said, I thought you'd never ask. And they were really delighted when I went out and got that. So that was my career up in the Aleutian Islands. And like I say, I think it's the best thing that ever happened to America, World War II. Really do. Is that enough?
Thank you.